When I got into this business back in 1998, the number of people who are really focused on good quality, long-term investing has really gone by the wayside.
What has he learned as an investor? Find out on Consuelo Mack Wealth Track.
Funding provided by Clearbridge Investments, the Fairholm Foundation, First Eagle Investments, Bill Miller, Baird, Strategus Asset Management, Research Affiliates, Royce Investment Partners, Seafarer Capital Partners, and Women Investing in Security and Education.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Wealth Track. I'm Consuelo Mack. As Wealth Track marks its 20th anniversary, we are taking stock of the changes that have occurred in the markets and investing over the decades with some of our extraordinary investor and financial thought leader guests. One of the great investors of our era is with us today for the second of a two-part interview. You can see the first episode about current market conditions and strategy on WealthTrack.com. Our guest is David Giroux, best known as the portfolio manager of the T. Rowe Price Capital Appreciation Fund, which he has run since 2006. Capital Appreciation is rated five-star gold by Morningstar. Giroux is a six-time nominee and two-time winner of Morningstar's Fund Manager of the Year Award and has also won Best Fund Awards from Lipper. And Capital Appreciation set a record for long-term performance by the same portfolio manager by beating its Morningstar peer group average for 17 consecutive years as of year-end 2024. The previous record holder was the legendary investor Philip Corray with the Pioneer Fund between 1938 and 1953. Quite an accomplishment. Giroux has more than 25 years of investment experience under his belt, having started at T. Rowe Price as an analyst in 1998. I asked him how much the markets have changed in the last quarter of a century.
I think the markets have changed in a number of ways. There's some structural changes in the market composition. There's also some changes in the people who invest in the market. So if you think about what the market looked like, in 2006, for example, right? That was a market where 45% of the earnings of the market came from energy, financials, materials. It was a very cyclical, kind of old school, old world, kind of less technology exposure market, right? Today, we have a market where those three, financials, energy, materials are about half that exposure that they were 18 years ago. And that composition has changed. It's a lot more heavy in terms of the largest weights. Five or six companies represent more than a third of the market today. Yeah, it makes that job a little bit more difficult given how big that weight is in the market in some of those companies. I would also say from an investor perspective that when I got into this business back in 1998, the number of hedge funds, the number of people who are really focused on good quality long-term investing has really gone by the wayside. So many investors today are trying to make a call in the quarter. What's going to work next week? What's going to work next month? The number of investors who are kind of focused on what's going to work in 2026 or 2027, 2028, that kind of longer-term perspective, that I think really is a hallmark of T. Rowe Price. There's so much intellectual capital in our industry is all going to kind of trying to solve these short-term issues. Like, what's Home Depot's comp going to be this quarter, this week, that month, right? As opposed to where's the best return in the marketplace? And I think as a result of that, the market has become a little bit more of a momentum market over time, right? Whatever you buy what's working, you focus on the short term. And I think in many ways, that makes the market more inefficient. If fewer people are trying to take advantage of the opportunities that we're taking advantage of, that long-term perspective, finding that great company that's going through some near-term challenges or where the current macroeconomic consensus doesn't agree with that company, those are great opportunities for us. And we don't have a lot of people competing with us in the same way that we would have had in 1998.
How do you get away with not going with the market, with the momentum, with the the short-term incremental trading against all the algorithms and the computers and the PhD physicists that are on trading desks? It almost sounds like you're doing what you would have done as what you did when you started out in 1998 as an analyst, and yet the rest of the market has taken it into a whole new direction. And they've made a ton of money doing that as well. They've also lost a ton of money, but you never hear about that. But how have you managed to you and T. Rowe Price to stay with that old-fashioned, you know, stock by stock, business by business discipline?
I always think about where do you have competitive advantage, right? I think if you have competitive advantage, you want to take all of your resources, all your team's resources, and apply those areas where you have competitive advantage, right? So where is the market inefficient? How can we take advantage of that market inefficiency? And let's take all our team's resources and try to figure that stuff out better than the market does. And I tell you, calling Home Depot's quarter, calling a retail's monthly sales, we have no advantage. We're going to be outcompeted on data. We're going to be outcompeted on intellectual property. That's not one place we can win. And I would actually argue that we've had this 16-year track record of outperforming our peers year after year, even though we take a longer-term horizon. In 2022, you know, cyclicals were really out of favor, right? Because Jamie Dimon and everybody else in the world said, hey, we're going to go to recession. So these were uninvestable for a lot of part of the market. We said, maybe there'll be a recession. Maybe there won't be a recession. Even if there is a recession in the next 5 years, we're going to make mid-teens kind of returns from this level. And when there was a recession, you made a lot of money, right? Because we're not trying to outperform the market every day, every hour, every minute. We're trying to outperform the market in that five-year perspective. And by taking all of our firms, all my team's resources, all T. Rowe's resources, and saying, let's not focus on that quarter. Let's focus on earnings power, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29. What's the right multiple? How is it going to be evolving? How is it going to be getting better? How is it going to be getting worse? And having that IRR drive our the way we invest as opposed to what's working. If you are just following the momentum of the market, you are the last car on a roller coaster. And I think that's why so many active managers systematically underperform, because they're always chasing things that have already gone up a lot.
Right.
And then they sell after it's down a lot. It's unfortunate for our industry that, you know, a lot of people kind of benchmark hug and they kind of just are momentum investors, and we try to take a different tack. That works most years for us, and hopefully it'll work in the future.
David, you started out in the business at T. Rowe Price as an associate analyst. How has your job as an analyst changed in the last, 25, 26 years, or has it changed?
I have all these titles, but the core of what I do is I'm an analyst. I'm looking through models, I'm building estimates, I'm trying to figure out what Ameren's going to earn in 2029 or what NYSERDA's going to earn in 2029, what's the right multiple for those companies. You know, I was talking to a utility management today for an hour. The core of what I do every day is an analyst. And honestly, that role has not changed dramatically. What I would say that we always aim for continuous improvement. We always want to get better every year from a process standpoint. And our process over time has introduced new tools into the toolkit that has made our process better. A gentleman named Farish Shughi, we implement a little more quantitative analysis into our work. Farish Shughi, who's the head of quant at TRPIM, T. Rowe Price Investment Management, I interact with Farish on a weekly, if not daily basis, and we talk about some of these inefficiencies. So one of the inefficiencies that he's helped me work with is, we know that when the market is down a lot, when VIX is high, when there's a lot of insider buying, boy, that's a great signal to go all into equities or buy a lot of risk assets, right? It may not feel good, but boy, when you have that combination of those things working in your favor, if you have a long-term horizon, you want to go all in. That is a great insight to us. We're incorporating a little more insider buying data. Company Marvell is a company that we bought recently. That was a company that, we hadn't focused on insider buying as much. Now it's incorporated in our process. We saw the CEO buy a lot of stock, I think at $70, and I think the stock's $112, $115 today on a great quarter here. So, what I would tell you is that our process, we want to get better from a process perspective every year. I think that's an important goal.
Are there a lot of other factors that you are now considering that are intangibles beyond the numbers?
One of the things we've learned over time, I think this is not a new phenomenon here, but management quality really matters. I think I probably told you or told your viewers the story in the past of when I heard GE, Larry Culp, was becoming the CEO of GE. We had zero GE, and I did nothing for the next 2 weeks, 14 days, 14 hours a day, 14 hours a day, just going through GE, piecing it apart, learning about the long-term care liability, to the point where I could get comfortable that we could, that GE was, had a lot of upside. So, you know, that management quality really matters a lot. And I would say any time in my career, we don't do it as often as we used to, but anytime in my career, when you invest with a management team that's not an A, you tend to get disappointed, right? You get disappointed from a how good their operational perspective is, you get disappointed in capital allocation, you get disappointed on a variety of things, on EPS growth, right? So we really focus a lot on management. That is an evolution in our strategy. When I took over the strategy in 2006, what we had in the portfolio for management quality versus management quality today, it's a night and day. That is really an important part of our process. That goes to that intangible side. And also, again, you mentioned your capital allocation, the book I wrote. Capital allocation comes up in almost every management meeting that we have.
You know, and you bring it up.
I bring it up.
Okay,
It's so important. How much free cash are you generating? What are you buying? What are you using it for? What's the right leverage level? What are the returns on that? That is an important part of our process. Trying to find the company, you know, you think about Danaher, Thermo, Revvity, what they did from a capital allocation perspective really changed their business models. These were 4% organic growth companies that basically did a lot of great acquisitions over a period of time and transitioned their portfolios from 4% organic growth to 7 or 8% organic growth. Maybe in Danaher's case, maybe even 9% organic growth potentially. So if you can find those companies that are getting better, that are deploying capital well, you get the double whammy of very fast EPS growth and a higher multiple over time. That's where low double-digit kind of EPS growth can translate into high total shareholder return perspective over a longer period of time, like we had with Thermo, like we had with Roper, like we had with Danaher.
You are in a position now where you have the luxury of being able to invest in companies that don't pay off immediately. You can stay with a turnaround at GE, for instance, for 5 years or however long it took before it really got its, it did what Larry Culp wanted to do there in turning GE around. But a lot of corporate CEOs, they don't have that luxury, right? So is that another factor?
I think if a company has a good process, good capital allocation, they're doing all the right things from a process standpoint, but the end market's not helping them, I find most boards are pretty accommodating that. Which you just don't want to have a situation where a company continually misses their numbers, continually makes bad investment decisions. And that brings activists into the camp, and it also, you know, you have a situation where, you know, management get removed in those situations. You know, I mentioned Ford was a situation where, you know, the management team did a lot of really great things. I mean, a lot of really difficult things. They did a lot of tough things, but they deployed capital at a subpar level relative to their peers. And now we have two new CEOs that we think are going to fix that, right? Autodesk is a company that we own that, you know, for, and we would not have owned Autodesk in the past, but, you know, there's an activist there. It's a management team at Autodesk that has consistently underperformed, underdelivered on margins and top line growth, where we think there's a high probability that you'll have a new CEO in place, a new CFO, a new board in place, probably in 6 to 9 months from now, and there's a lot of upside from that company being managed better. In the same way, there was a lot of upside from GE being managed better as well.
And David, CEOs, in order to get to where they've gotten at that high a level, they've got to be pretty good salespeople.
One of the things we talked about in the book is the idea that most people who become CEOs, they become CEOs because they are great salesmen, because they're great at operations. They often don't become CEO because they're great at capital allocation.
No.
Sometimes when we're interacting with management teams, it's not just asking questions with capital allocation, it's providing feedback to management teams based on our expertise of following what an amazing job Larry Culp did. You know, what a great job Brian Jellison at Roper, right? We provide some perspective on that, and I think in many cases helps that those management teams make better capital allocation decisions.
Another evolution in the markets is the move towards passive investing. Tell us about that evolution in the market and how that has changed your role as a money manager and how you've adapted to this massive move to passive investing, to index investing?
Well, it's funny. I always tell people that as an active manager who works as an active manager at a mutual fund company, the move to passive has not been good for T. Rowe Price, not been good for a lot of active managers, because you're kind of are part of the industry, ours is losing a little bit of share, right?
Yes.
But as an investor or as a client of CAF or the CAF strategies, it's actually a good thing because you have more and more people who are making investment decisions not based on individual company analysis. They're making decisions like, I want to go buy healthcare, I want to go buy utilities, or I want to go buy S&P 500, I want to go small caps. The thing I've always told people is, when you buy the S&P 500, you buy a lot of great companies, but you buy 375 companies also that have multiple fatal flaws. These are companies that have bad management teams, bad capital allocation, have secular challenges,
right.
They can't grow EPS at a high single-digit rate, they're high beta, or they have extreme valuations. In a normal world where we didn't have passive, investors would say, I don't want to own these 375 companies. I want to own those 125 great companies. But as an index investor, you are kind of forced to buy all 500 companies. You're forced to buy companies that have challenges in their business models. I think the other thing with regard to passive is I think that the challenge our industry faces is that too many people in our industry hug their benchmark. And if you have a 60 basis point fee or 70 basis point fee or 80 basis point fee, and you're competing against someone that has a 1 basis point fee, and you're trying to hug the benchmark, you're almost locking in underperformance, right? You're almost locking in performance. That's why it's so important for cash shareholders. The reason we've been able to outperform the market by 380 basis points for the last 17 years or 18 years is we own 50, 60 stocks. We don't own 200 stocks, right? We're not trying to not lose, we're trying to win. That's really, really important to our strategy. What are the best 50, 60 stocks in the marketplace? Let's make big, big bets on them, and let's not try to index hug. If I was an individual, what would I want to own for myself? That's how I think about this. Not what I'm going to do that reduces my risk of getting fired, right? I think so many people are kind of willing to accept mediocrity in our industry.
As far as the capital appreciation fund, How did you end up deciding that you wanted to have a focused fund, long-term oriented? I mean, where did that thought come from? Where did that idea come from?
I would tell you, and again, we may have mentioned him earlier, but one of the people who's probably the most positive impact on CAF's process, from a process standpoint, is a guy named Farah Shughi, who runs the T. Rowe Price Investment Management Quant Group. And I've worked with him very, very closely over my career. And I think he's done a really good job of helping me understand from a market perspective, where are the best risk returns in the marketplace? In equities and fixed income. That has been really, really helpful. Taking a longer term perspective, you actually generate higher returns in that structure. Oh, these are the characteristics when you want to go all into equities. So I always tell people that I probably should have been fired in 2006, 2009, because I had no idea what I was doing as a portfolio manager. I had no process. It was really, really, starting to work with Ferris in that time and his team, starting to invest, with Mark Casper at Thermo Fisher, which was like, oh, this is a great GARP stock. Let's make it a big bet. Let's find more companies that look a lot like Thermo Fisher. That really helped our process evolve dramatically from what was really disjointed process or a lack of process in kind of 2006, 2009, to this kind of continuous improvement, go after market inefficiency. Let's identify those market inefficiencies. Let's go after them hard. Let's spend all of our team's resources, all of my resources, on those 125 stocks where we think the odds of outperformance are really, really high, and make big bets. And let's try to win. Let's not try not to lose. There's a real difference between trying to win and trying not to lose.
And explain that difference.
Well, I think if you're trying not to lose, you index hug. And
right.
And again, if you have a fee structure that is too high relative to passive strategies, and you're hugging a benchmark, your odds of outperforming are very, very low. And again, a lot of the assets that have gone to passive, I think, have been taken from people who are closet index huggers, who had basically an inefficient product from a tax perspective, from a from a fee perspective. And I think we've always taken the attitude that You know, I want to generate the greatest risk-adjusted return for our clients we possibly can. There is no way we can generate 380 basis points of annual outperformance if I own 200 stocks and I hug the benchmark, right? That's, you know, your odds of outperformance go down much lower. Your odds of outperforming by a big magnitude go down much lower. And again, that's really always been our focus.
One of the biggest changes recently has been this phenomenon called artificial intelligence. And I know that at T. Rowe Price, you have done basically a screen, an AI screen of all of your investments, right? Of how they are going to be affected by AI or how they are responding to AI. So that's a whole new area of investing.
AI is changing dramatically, right? Sometimes I feel best in owning, you know, think about an industrial company or a healthcare company, that the range of outcomes is really, really narrow for the next 5 years, pretty easily to be predict what it's going to look like. There's still a lot of question marks around AI and how that's going to evolve. And so we are doing constant channel checks. We're doing constant calls with experts, trying to understand how AI is changing. It is really unlike anything we've invested in the last 10 years, where it's changing so dramatically. And there's so much short-term things going on that we really have to stay on top of to make sure that we don't get caught off guard. And again, one of the things, you know, what is the second derivative impact of AI? Again, one of the things we did get right this year before the market was, hey, AI is going to benefit regulated utilities in a meaningful way, and the market is out to lunch on this fact. And so we had a big overweight in utilities, and that worked really well for us in the second half of this year, getting ahead of that. So making sure we understand not just the first derivative impacts of all the things we're talking about, what are the second derivative impacts of everything we're talking about, AI? Who benefits, who kind of loses, and how is that changing potentially over time?
And so that's just an ongoing process that you're going to be doing for many, many years to come, it sounds like.
It is the single largest consumption of time for both me and my whole team. It's such an important issue, not just for the NVIDIAs and AMDs and Marvells of the world. It's important for understanding the second derivative impacts. How does it impact software in a positive, negative way, right? How does it impact Meta or Google?
David, one investment for a long-term diversified portfolio, one company that you think should be in our children's, grandchildren's long-term portfolio?
I'm going to recommend Rivety. This is a company that, again, it's really changed dramatically. They sold off their more industrial assets a couple of years ago. Today, it's mostly a software, reagents, immunodiagnostics business. Those are all what I call 30 multiple businesses. And that's like 70% of the profitability of the company today. And I think those are growing faster than the rest of the business as well. This is a company that will probably grow revenues, the high end of the life science tool group, with lower volatility than the rest of the life science tool group. Margins are like 28-29% today. We think they'll be 35% in the future. Cap allocation here is really good. They're buying back a lot of stock. Their M&A track record is excellent. Prahlad Singh, who's the CEO there, is just an excellent human being, but also a really great manager. And this is a company that's going to compounded wealth at a, you know, 12 to 50% rate over the next 5 years. When we do our bottoms-up estimates for the S&P 500, Rivety actually has the highest IRR in the whole market today as we look at it.
David Drew, it's such a treat to have you on Wealth Track as always, and thank you for taking a much longer term view than we normally do. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate the invitation. Love the conversations. This long-term discussions is what I like to focus on too. So thank you.
At the close of every Wealth Track, we try to give you one suggestion to help you build and protect your wealth over the long term. This week's action point is a recommendation David Giroux made to WealthTrack a year ago, and it is one we have suggested as well. It is read Thinking Fast and Slow by Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman. Now considered a classic, the book originally published in 2011 is about how the brain works in making decisions. The now deceased Kahneman, a pioneering behavioral psychologist, and his then late colleague Amos Tversky, to whom the book is dedicated, identified what they call dual process brains, divided between the fast system number one, quick, intuitive, and yes, sometimes even delusional, and the slow system number two, deliberate, requiring effort and concentration, thus tiring easily. In a Wealth Track Extra interview, Giroux called it probably the most important book about investing, which is not actually technically about investing, that every investor should read. Giroux told us that the book has really revolutionized how we, in this case T. Rowe Price, approach forecasting, how we think about the right inputs, how we think about making decisions in the right way. High praise from one of our era's great investors and financial thought leaders. Thinking Fast and Slow is a must-read for all of us. Next week, as we continue to celebrate our 20th anniversary year, we will tap the wisdom of yet another investment and financial thought leader. Stay tuned. In this week's extra feature, we asked David Giroux for another book recommendation to help us become successful investors. Please follow us on Facebook, X, and our YouTube channel. Thank you for watching. Have a stimulating weekend and make the week ahead a healthy, profitable, and productive one.